Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 759. Hey, I want to plug some stuff.
Ooh.
There is a Kickstarter which is crushing right now, but there's
what's it for?
I don't know if you've ever heard of a little program called
Masterpiece Theater,
Lidsville.
Oh, good, nice, good poll. That has to be someone is like, we could kickstart this.
No, it's Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, you mean the greatest thing ever?
Joel Hodgson has launched a Kickstarter to bring back. They're trying to raise $2 million to make 3 episodes of MST, 3K, and if they raise $5 million, they'll do an entire season for 12.
Hey, guys, let's get on this so we can all get the thing we want.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, it's very expensive to make a show.
Yes.
They have to rebuild the bots and do
all
that stuff.
Put it back up into space.
Put it back up into space, build the satellite of love. But, yeah, I mean,
that's what the UFO was, by the way, the other night.
They were launching the satellite
test flights for the
satellite. They were already, yeah, they just launched it today. No, they just launched it a couple of days ago, and they're already well on their way, but they haven't hit the goal yet.
Hey,
so.
Eccentric millionaire fans listening, let's make this happen.
So, Mystery Science Theater, I believe the URL is bringbackmst3k.com.
I just type that into random web bars anyway.
Well, now it'll actually lead to something. Kyle, what do you got in the Nerds Community Cork Board?
Jason Newman, who's been inspired to make his own thing based on your suggestion.
Fuck you!
And he has a podcast called After These Messages. It's a 5-minute podcast that goes out, I believe, once a week, and it's a fictional series of commercial breaks for something. So it's all fake commercials that he's built out together. It's super cool. Like, I kind of like love weird stuff like this. It's kind of a mix of a little bit of Fire Sign Theater and sort of cool like breakdowns, like, you know, and, you know, I Love Me a commercial parody, so I'm just a real sucker for this. I just think it's a real cool thing. He's on iTunes under the podcast section with After These Messages, and he's also got a SoundCloud for it. That's SoundCloud/After These Messages.
People love your recommendations, Kyle, so I'm
I do have
very
impeccable
much
taste. I really do. Like,
self-aware, son of a bitch.
Very few things I'm confident about besides being a fun time tastemaker.
You're so good at life.
Yeah, well, no, I'm bad at life, but I'm good at looking at things that people should do instead of living life.
Well, there's the tagline for your fucking
sitcom. I would also
plug
December 4th. I'm doing my album recording at Meltdown. It's an evening with Kyle Clark, and I'm recording my album there, so it'll be good. December 4th, Meltdown, 9 p.m.
I'm going to be
out of town performing.
I know.
Scout and I will be there.
Yeah.
Good for you, though.
It's going to be super fun.
This episode of the podcast is Punch Brothers.
Yeah.
One of my favorite bands. Chris Thiele is maybe...
kind of a genius.
Kind of. He played this whole Bach piece on YouTube on a fucking mandolin. It is unbelievable.
It's pretty impressive.
The band is great, but also Gnome, like the rest of the band, they're
the prog rock of bluegrass.
It's like a bunch of geniuses just came together and all
put on fun hats.
They have their latest album is called Phosphorescent Blues.
It's
is
real good.
Spectacular. I mean, it is bluegrassy, but there's also like classical structure to it as well. I mean, it's fucking, they're so fucking great. And they've, I mean, for years I've adored Punch Brothers. They've in addition to their own music, they've done some amazing like Radiohead covers, and
they've really transcended. I feel like starting in the bluegrass world, but then moving into, I think that they've taken elements of a lot of the cool like freaky folk stuff that's gone on, and sort of the prog experimental music scene, playing with suites of stuff. They're really a really interesting and cool band.
Yeah, they have a pretty great Strokes cover, too. That's,
oh, it's so good.
Yeah, everything about it. But besides their covers, their original songs are fantastic. They have upcoming tour dates that can be found at punchbrothers.com. And, yeah, I got to go hang out with them before their show with The Greek, and it was spectacular. So I'm very excited that these guys are on. This is the Nerdist Podcast number 759 with Punch Brothers. Katie, get there. Roll that thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Makes your baby cuter, makes itself taste sweeter.
Official start either. I think we just start ultimately is how okay. It usually.
Okay, let's, we'll tell.
Hey y'all, I think we're gonna do this.
Time, all right.
And so we're just gonna pass this back and forth. What you doing? Brother Ted, where you at? Yeah, did you have the coldies?
Yeah.
Over
a little bit more.
Do you want some room? I can squeeze in over here.
Perfect.
Bam. I guess let's just go down and everyone introduce themselves so people listening can try to get a sense of who's whom.
All right. All right. That would.
Starting now?
Yes.
I'm Paul Coward. I play the bass in Punch Brothers.
I'm Chris Aldridge, but everybody's going to call me Critter. I'm the guitar player.
Also in Punch Brothers.
Oh, yeah. I'm in Punch Brothers.
Questions. Did you know he was going to be here, too? Oh. This other Punch Brothers?
Wait, how many bands are called the Punch Brothers?
Yeah, this is...
There's a lot. There's a lot of Punch Brothers bands.
And they're all pretty.
The other ones really aren't that great. Yeah. There's a Zydeco band, which is the weirdest reference.
Yeah, polka band.
I'm Noam Pichalny, and I play banjo, coincidentally, in Punch Brothers.
Which is crazy.
This is...
You guys, you're not going to believe this.
Wait a minute.
Don't even.
Okay.
that was Gabe Witcher. He plays the fiddle in Punch Brothers.
You're right? Not also in Punch Brothers.
I am in Punch Brothers too.
This is amazing.
But we don't have to talk. We don't have
no,
to
I think
talk
it's
about
good.
That.
It's just, when I snuck backstage and I was banging on all the doors, I didn't realize that this would be an all Punch Brothers dressing room. But I think it's nice they've given you your own dressing room.
It is nice. There's fruit in here. That we have
four.
We have
just,
there's
five
four. Yeah, but there's that's true. So we're gonna have to fight over.
Yeah.
One guy is not going to get an orange.
I'm
Chris Thiele, by the way. I play the mandolin.
The flowers in a mason jar.
I took an Uber up here because the Greek is usually unapproachable.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the parking is usually not awesome. And the whole way from my house, it was Kiss FM hits. And I could not wait to get here to cleanse my ear. Like the second
wait, what did you hear? What did you hear?
Oh, it's a bunch of shit I don't even know. And then Shake It Off by Taylor Swift, yeah. Which, you know, I gotta be honest, I don't hate it.
No?
But everything else I heard, I was not was difficult.
And you know, you could link your Uber account to Spotify, and I figured like the best focus group possible is to get in an Uber and play your own music. Through Spotify just to see the driver's reaction, and then you could kind of cater your next album based on
that's a really
how
good idea.
Respond.
That's a really good idea. Well, this guy really enjoyed Kiss
Uber,
FM.
Wait, who was it? Two of us took an Uber recently, and the guy, or no, wait, it might have been a
no,
London
it was us.
Cat. It was you and me,
no,
right?
No, it was, yeah, and he was asking us about what we did, and we were in some town, I don't remember. He's like, oh, you're playing, oh, cool, what's the name of your band? We told him.
And then, London. Like, we were in London.
In London. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then like, 15 seconds later, he had it pulled up on Spotify, and we were listening to our record.
Oh, that's
in
amazing!
London cabin. It was very strange.
Also, his reference was, oh, I love this. I'm a big Elvis fan.
Oh yeah, I
mean, yeah.
exactly the same.
That's right.
There's pop music, and then everything else.
Well, I think we're both American.
I think you're just lucky. Yeah. He wasn't like, are you like Pitbull? Like he thought you were like Pitbull. And you're not. You guys are truly one of my favorite bands, and I've been stalking you for years. We've been sort of talking around, like, oh, we have to get you on the podcast, and it's just our travel schedules are shitty.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you guys are in the middle of a crazy long tour. And
this finally at the very, at the end of this
close,
one.
Close.
But then another one will start.
But then there's another one right around the corner. How many dates have you guys done?
This year?
This year, yeah.
Oh, what?
I mean,
I don't know.
It's best not. The math breaks down.
And you've never been to the Greek before?
This is the first time at the Greek.
For us to play.
I celebrated by stopping at Gelson's on the way over here for diapers.
Yeah. This guy... And that'd be...
I think you're going to make it through the set just fine.
We should mention that he has a... he does have a newborn baby.
No, you shouldn't have mentioned that.
Oh.
Just let people try to figure out like why you would need diapers. Well, that must be a fucking crazy show. Yeah.
You know, you got to figure out if you're going to be a band, you know, Slipknot already has happened. So you have to figure out a new way to shock people.
Right.
That's really funny. Then you play these beautifully executed songs, and then everyone just shits their pants on stage.
Right.
It's just like a nice little bonus part at
it's
the end.
It's better than banter.
That's true.
Yeah.
This is like punk bluegrass.
Nothing more punk than that.
That's, there is nothing more punk than shitting oneself.
I guarantee, like, the...
Well, maybe no diapers would be a little bit more punk. Just kind of being up there.
Yeah, but the,
just let it flow,
why,
let it flow.
That's why I stopped. That's why I stopped for diapers, is because this is a seated show, and you want to just tone it, you want to tone it down a little bit.
Yeah, bluegrass classes it up just enough to use the diaper.
Right.
But it's like sort
What's
of...
What's the difference between punk and bluegrass?
It's acoustic. It's acoustic. It's like... Yeah.
But it's an old rag, because it's like, it's old-timey.
Oh, yeah.
It's old-timey.
Yeah.
It's like cloth diapers.
You know what's interesting?
Carter Stanley shat in this. Sorry. Blasphemy. Blasphemy.
The Greek is the Greek sounds amazing. You got it's. It I think it's personally the best venue in Los Angeles.
This is amazing. Amazing.
Place. I like it better than the Hollywood Bowl. It's a little. It feels more intimate. The bowl, the farther back you go, just you might as well just be in across the street.
Also, it's a little wine. It's a little wine and cheesy at the bowl. Sometimes
it is a little wine. Yeah, yeah. And this,
I love the bowl. I love the bowl.
Yeah,
but
would love to play there.
Yes, that's right.
Would love to play there.
Still would love to play there.
Well, no one's listening. They're gonna be like, "Did you hear what they said? They're not gonna fucking play the bowl now."
Boy, not if I have anything to do with it.
I'm Ted Ball,
pick your
owner of the Hollywood Bowl, and I'm never gonna let these guys in my venue. But I saw Heart here, and it was incredible. Oh. Like maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And Ann Wilson just blew the doors off the place.
Oh, hell yeah.
And saw Weird Al here, which was an amazing
show. Wait, how long ago?
Oh, this was probably also about 10 years ago.
Wait, was he doing Bye Bye This Here Anakin Guy, the actual Star Wars American Pie thing?
Yes, he did.
Because I used to sing all of that. I learned all of it, and I would attempt to impress girls at Murray State University, which, of course... failed attempt.
Yeah, I was going to say, how'd that go for you?
Well, that's why you gotta. If you'd gone to Comic-Con and done that, then it would have worked.
Right.
But just at a regular university,
no,
that may not be
Comic-Con Paducah.
They barely, they barely even slowed down on their walk by me.
But this place, this is it, and we're in a dressing room that obviously has not changed since the 70s.
Yeah.
And is if you backed into the wall, you could get pregnant. Like, I can't even imagine what horrible, wonderful things must have happened in the exact place we're sitting right now.
You know, there's some unfound cocaine in the wall
somewhere. Yeah. Somewhere. If you just snort the carpet, you would probably.
When we sat down on the couch, it's just a puff of white smoke.
Yeah, this explains a lot.
But that's right. The interview is going wonderfully.
But the Punch Brothers living hard with their bag of zinc. The coldies.
Actually, we have the coldies. You know, it's the end of this tour. Everyone's nursing something.
Yeah, it's. I mean, how do you protect your voices on the road? How do you protect your physical health when you're? Because I don't ever. I just go back and forth. I don't ever go out for months at a time. But you guys are just on the road, it seems like. So how are you able to?
It's just that golden balance of coffee and alcohol. You have to find you have to find exactly the perfect amount of both.
Yep.
And then mix them together.
And then you get sick when you get home, like the day after you're done.
It's always your body realizes you don't wait, we don't have to stand on stage for 2 hours tonight. Then I'm out.
Yeah.
When I have when I've been a trumpeter for the, not a literal trumpeter, but when I've told people about Punch Brothers, like, you gotta listen to Punch Brothers. And when I describe it, I say, well, it's bluegrass, but it's also kind of classical at the same time. It seems like there's classical influence, but through this sort of bluegrass lens. Like the version you guys did of the Brandenburg Concerto was unbelievable.
Oh, thank you.
So where did you guys, like, what was the sort of founding philosophy of the band? When did you guys get together, and how did you kind of find this really specific intersection of these two different types of music?
Well, actually, 10 years ago, while you were watching Weird Al,
I was watching Weird Al at the
Greek, we'd known each other, Gabe, the fiddle player, and
me.
I, Chris, mandolin. we had known each other since I was 7 and you were 9. Met in Azusa at the Follows Camp Festival.
Azusa.
Nice.
living large in Azusa.
Exactly.
And had always talked about doing something together, but when I met Noam again, he always reminds me. We had met
previously. The first time didn't register.
Yeah.
You still have no memory of meeting him the first time?
Now I think I do, but only because I've been reminded about it so many times. Yeah. When I met him, then it became clear. It's like, oh, this thing that I've wanted to do with Gabbers forever. It's if it's going to be fiddle and mandolin and banjo, then regardless of what, you know, the core of the thing's going to be stylistically, at least on the surface of it, it's going to be kind of bluegrassy.
Right.
We'll need a guitar and a bass,
right,
to just sort of round out the package. Also, that way we know what those instruments do. So even if we're not going to use them in their sort of traditional capacity, we know what they do. Just like if you're like good with certain colors, you're going to paint whatever you're going to paint with those colors.
Right.
And that's kind of how we look at it. So the fact that all five of us are into classical music, that comes out in certain ways. You know, we're also into, just any number of things. But these are the instruments we have to work with, so.
Not that many people can play Bach on a mandolin, though, or all the different. And it's one of my favorite things about bluegrass as a style is that it does seem to be the, because I assume, you know, when it started, people are in these mountain towns and they're just entertaining each other, and they have to be able to cover every different frequency of music without a microphone, you know, yeah, like without being amplified. And so I feel like that's why I think it's so easy to cover music in bluegrass, because it can just pull the basic elements of anything and make it sound good.
That's a great point, that you've got every, you know, the band, the actual ensemble runs the gamut, just as far as, you know, the sonic capabilities of the thing. And what's fun is without having to plug in to anything.
Right.
You know, like we're around a single microphone just so that we can get onto the little thing here that's recording us.
The Zoom H4N.
There you go. Patent pending.
Yep.
This portion brought to you by Tascam.
Guitar Center's having a bi-weekly sale. There won't be prices like this until next Thursday. There's just too many guitars. There's too many Guitar Center sales.
I get an email every day from a specific person. It
at
always
reads,
yeah, at Guitar Center. It comes up as this guy's email
it's
address.
Your brother. You're so cruel.
But he's always, this whoever this is at Guitar Center is so upset with me. You haven't come in for so long. It says in these emails. It's like very personal.
Wow. So now they're just, their new branding is just to guilt people into coming in.
We notice you haven't been in
you
for a long
write,
time.
Hey, you never buy picks anymore.
Yeah, exactly. What's the deal, man?
I just wonder if there are always sales. Doesn't that mean that there are never sales? Like, because that feels like that's sort of where the.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've not been to a Guitar Center in a long time. I just order everything online. Where do you guys find, you know, if you're on the road and you pop a bass string or something, or you are like, what do you do?
That's never happened.
Okay.
What happens, like, when you forget to bring your bass?
There it is. That has happened.
When you forget to bring your bass?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, it sounds, I don't know, 4-1 sounds that, like maybe that has happened.
One time we flew to Germany, and I forgot to bring a bass.
Now, when you're on your way to the airport, did you remember that you were going to a gig, or were you like, yay, Germany?
That was in the middle of a lot of touring. It's all a little bit hazy, man.
Gotcha.
He didn't hit the crucial balance between caffeine and alcohol.
Did you one or the other?
Do you go into some fine German instrument shop and buy like a viola and just slap it? Is that how that works?
This will work. No, I found a guy.
Pedal. Found, Guitar Center.
Yeah, found a guy from Brooklyn in Germany who had an amazing bass that fit my pickup, and everything. It was kind of miraculous.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's one of those experiences that should have taught me a lesson, but it ended up being great.
Yeah, so the lesson here was don't fucking worry about anything. Yeah. Like, it's all going to be fine.
That's the lesson.
Where do you guys fit in terms of, because I had some dear friends who were in a bluegrass band called the Cousin Lovers.
Yes.
They were a phenomenal band, phenomenal live band, and at the time, around 2001, 2002, they were having difficulty because they were kind of playing modern themes with bluegrass instruments, and so they had difficulty finding a place. Like, Nashville was like, well, you're not bluegrass enough, and other places were like, you're too bluegrass. And then the bluegrass snobs were like, well, it's not technically. It's like they, but they were such an amazing band Do you find some of the same? I mean, obviously not. You're playing great venues, but how do you define it, really?
It was actually that was a total issue at the outset of the band, because we look like a bluegrass band. I mean, just we wear suits. We play the five instruments that are commonly associated with bluegrass, and so I think initially you have a bunch of these people who their whole mission in life is to only ever listen to bluegrass, specifically traditional bluegrass music. That's all that they ever want to pass through their ears. And so they would come because it looks right, and then they would be really upset because it doesn't sound right.
That's so
awesome. I think people got their hopes up after Nickel Creek. They saw that Chris Thiele was putting a bluegrass band together, you know, ostensibly because there was a banjo all of a sudden. People thought maybe now he's finally returning to his roots. And then we got on stage and played a, you know, 45-minute string quintet in four movements as kind of our initial mission statement. So people were a little blindsided. But as far as, like, the location, like, in our infancy as a band, we were all in New York City. And we were playing locally. We were playing at the Living Room. At one point, we were playing there once a week, right? And then it became once a month, and then every couple months, and once a year. But we were all in the same city. That was the last time that we were all living in the same place was when we were in New York. And people didn't really seem to be too concerned, at least our audience that was starting to grow at that point out of those local shows. People weren't really concerned with whether we were authentically bluegrass or if we were on the fringes or not. I think there may have been some novelty to the fact that we were playing these instruments, or maybe not novelty, a bit of exoticism that, like, wow, what is this, like, bluegrass band doing playing Radiohead, like, in the East Village on Thursday night at midnight? And so I think people got excited, and it really fueled us, and it kind of gave us the, I think, a lot of initial encouragement to keep doing what we were doing because of the response within our little community there.
I mean, your original songs are amazing, and Phosphorescent Blues is a great album, but your covers are also there. There's a great video online of you guys doing, speaking of Radiohead, a Pack Like Sardines in a Crushed Tin Box. I think you're in Portland.
Yeah,
yeah. And
the Chamber of Music Northwest.
And yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're in this. You're basically you're playing where chamber music plays,
right?
And it sounds phenomenal. Did you? Is there a specific type of venue that you guys prefer playing, or does it not matter?
It kind of matters a little bit. We actually did struggle to kind of fit the music with the venue, and we have fortunately have enough variety now to where if we're in a venue that's maybe going to be standing and louder than a seated concert hall, we can kind of tailor our set to fit into that and
the setup
and
too.
The and like the setup
how we,
yeah
how we actually amplify the thing, you know, we'll have like today playing the Greek, you know, kind of in festival conditions, as one says, we have a bigger setup. We've got, you know, he actually plays some drums. Our fiddle player will actually hit drums with his fiddle bow.
Yeah.
You gotta check that out.
That's pretty badass.
But then you know, you get into one of these beautiful concert halls, and we'll kind of strip down to the single mic,
and it all acoustically around one microphone. Yeah. So yeah, we did run into some times where we were trying to play the 42-minute string quintet in a rock club.
And then also recently have run into the other issue where you, like, you show up in a beautiful concert hall wanting to play, you know, like a raucous Strokes cover, and realizing this is not,
you know, maybe a couple years in, we were playing some really beautiful rooms, and we were, you know, making a good living as a band in its infancy, like for being around for 2 years, and we kind of thought that.
Oh, look at that little guy!
Right on cue, infancy.
You made a person.
I made a person.
That's his manager.
That's more true than you know.
Speaking of our infancy,
he's very upset because the writer said pork rinds. There were no pork rinds. He is throwing a fit.
Really unhappy.
I think having a baby manager would be pretty rad, because I think the venue would be like, fuck, I don't know, just give them whatever they want.
Yeah.
Baby, Okay, fine. Longer set. Longer set. Whatever. No curfew. No noise ordinance.
Don't fuck with that guy.
Yeah, it's so you mentioned the Strokes, then the Reptilia cover. Was that at a radio station?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was cold. It was cold as hell, which is why. So that I don't think there's a video of ours on YouTube that has more views than that one, and we look insane.
Because, I'm wearing an Elmer Fudd hat, like winter hunting cap.
We didn't know it was being filmed.
We had no idea it was being filmed.
It was like early enough to where it was maybe like every tenth radio performance they would film it and put it on the internet, but the rest of them just went out live. And
now you know.
Now you just know everything's going to get filmed.
Do you just assume that everything? I mean, how do you?
Yeah, there we go.
Taking pictures.
And so, yeah, we had nice hats on, scarves.
We looked ridiculous.
It was like 9 in the morning. We literally rolled in from the van.
I mean, it was the equivalent of, I think people might actually have been, you know, excited by it. Not because of the music. People may have thought, like, wow, we've found, you know, the new Village People. Like, it's like we've been waiting for something to come along, and they were just waiting for us to just start spelling something out with our bodies during that song.
And if you listen to the music, the new Village is a copper mining camp.
Yeah. Didn't Elton John give you shit for the way you looked?
Exactly.
Yeah. Elton John?
Elton John
is giving you shit busting for the balls eccentricity over this. Of your outfit.
Where are those goldfish shoes, EJ? Fucking talk to me. It's ridiculous.
I can't hear you through the Donald Duck head.
All the Captain Fantastic ears? Come on, never. Like that. You just get your card revoked for ever commenting on anyone ever again.
No, but that's how messed up our attire was that day.
Yeah.
Did you play? Did you do a show with him?
Yeah, a few years ago, T-Bone Burnett put together a benefit show called The Speaking Clock Review in New York, and Elton John was on it, and Leon Russell, a bunch of big stars, and Elton came backstage and like asked permission to come into our dressing room because he wanted to.
He started singing Rye Whiskey, and then gave a shit about that.
And then he started giving a shit about that video. He's like, he said, like, Pickles, where's your hat?
What? That's probably the most surreal thing.
That was true. That was amazing.
Are you able to? Do you get? What makes you? I assume you guys don't really get nervous anymore because you play so many shows that you're just locked in. But are you when you know that someone like Elton John is in the audience, or do you get nervous like if family and friends come to a show? Is there anything that kind of upsets you?
That's more nerve wracking to me. Like family and friends being there, people that you really know,
got an answer
and
to?
that they know. That you're full of shit. That, like, you know, I'm there trying to be cool, mm-hmm. and, you know, you play these songs, you work hard on these songs, and you kind of deliver them in character, and you know that this person knows that that's not real.
You also, you can also tell they can't lie to you. Like, if they don't like if they don't like the show, oh, yeah, you guys, that was real, you know?
Right, because you know what it sounds like when they're psyched.
Yes.
And they're like, that was great, man, that was great. You're like, oh God, my career is over.
No, it's not. It's just it just makes Thanksgiving weird. But other than that, it's not going to ruin your career.
That's true.
I saw you winning some award from Steve Martin on the Letterman show a few years ago, and that's because I first saw you guys at Largo. That's why the very first time I ever saw you was at Largo.
Speaking of covers, you joined us at the original Bluegrass situation.
I did.
To sing, what was it, from the Titanic?
Oh, was
wearing a wig. You were wearing a wig.
Yes, it was. Ed Helms called and said, will you do a glam metal cover? We're going to play bluegrass, but you sing glam metal of...
My Heart Will Go On?
Yeah, My Heart Will Go On. Yeah, I was actually going through the song. Like, I came... I'd done the show called The Rock of Ages, which was like all glam metal hits, so I still had my costume, so I brought it, and then they start the song, and then I came out and, you know, do the fire across that dip, you know, like all that. But it was, and it was really fun, but I think maybe that's where I saw you guys for the first time. To me, Steve Martin is the god of everything, and he's the reason that I ever wanted to do comedy, and I know he really doesn't like talking about comedy anymore, but I'm sure you were you a fan of his before?
Absolutely, yeah. And that was probably more surreal than Elton John giving me shit for my hat, because I deserved that. But getting to hang out with Steve and getting to do the award, that was, we were all kind of blindsided by that. I think you guys were really surprised.
It was amazing.
It went to Pickles.
Pickles. The other thing is that Pickles actually bought us all cocktails the night that he found out about that award, which hasn't happened again.
True.
you guys will have to concoct a fake award just to give him.
Yeah, this is the it's a booster shot for the Steve Martin Award. Anyways, yeah, we were all fans of his, and we got to hang out a bunch with him because of that that event, and he sat in with us on Rye Whiskey playing on Letterman. He's just an amazing guy. He is an absolute perfectionist as far as anything that's going to be done on stage or in front of an audience. He wanted to rehearse like crazy, more than anybody I've ever encountered. Like, he really wanted to rehearse that, and he wanted to rehearse the...
That goes for the music and for the bit.
And for the banter and the gag, which had this check on a retractable fishing line that was kind of mounted inside of his coat. Like, he wanted to run it a million times. And this was, for good measure, because... If it had failed in front of the audience, like, it would have really been a letdown to have to retape that segment. And,
But the check, basically, you had the check, thing. And Steve.
Yeah, so Steve magically. Steve handed me a check, and I put it into my pocket, and then 30 seconds later, or 10 seconds later, it flew back into his pocket from my pocket. It was a real magic trick, and it was something he learned back when he was doing magic, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and. We kept running the bit, and we did it in front of some friends at his place, and it failed every single time.
It
didn't work once in front of, like, another human being, and we got it to work a few times with just the two of us in the room, and finally he just got so frustrated with the thing that he wanted to figure out what was going wrong with the gizmo, and he took the thing apart and dissected this whole gizmo and rebuilt it and, like, tied the thing back together and had, like, this tiny little scissors and a tweezers, and was sitting there at his dining room table reconstructing this little gizmo he bought at some magic shop. And I just kind of had this sense of awe that Steve was doing this himself, that he didn't have some, you know, banjo check gizmo tech, right. You know, that just lives in some corner of his apartment, just in case.
In a cage. he feeds him whenever it's time to, like, fix a trick or put a string on.
Yeah, and I said to Steve, I said, I think this is really, really neat that you're, you know, working on this yourself and that you're still interested in doing this stuff. And he turned to me and said, I know. I can't believe that I'm here right now doing exactly the same thing I was doing 40 years ago.
But it's obvious that that's where his love is. That's, I mean, amazing, you know, man. He does. It seems like it sort of feels like he's sort of over. Like, I think if someone came up to him in public, and I know he's very shy, he would probably be more apt to respond if you said, like, I love the Steep Canyon Rangers, as opposed to, comedy's not pretty or whatever, right. You know, like, yeah. I think it feels like bluegrass is really where his soul lives now.
I think it's probably his main inspiration right now is playing music, but I do know he enjoys
things like of
artistic
things. Of things. Yeah. He'll get, I love people who dive to the core of whatever they might be interested in, and I think for him whatever he's up to is going to be informed by the things that he's interested in. And so, you know, there's always going to be, he's putting in so much energy into the appreciation of these other things so that whatever he happens to be putting out into the world, you know, he feels like he's got a good enough handle on these things that he loves. He can emulate them, improve upon them, you know, moving forward. I think it's a good way to be.
Do you have what is your trick if you, so this sort of legendary Prince story, Prince fucks something up on stage, he does it twice. So that people think it was on purpose.
Sure.
So if he fucks up a note or fucks, he just does it. He'll just do it again. People are like, wow, that's really cool.
Absolutely. Turn that shit into a sequence.
What are some of your what are some of your tricks? Like, if something goes sideways, do you have one? Any?
Well, repetition is definitely at the top of anyone's list of, like.
Well, I mean, it's it's really common. Like, I'll see it at shows all the time that you go see a live concert and someone will just miss something on their instrument or will sing something really out of tune, and they'll immediately turn towards like the monitor engineer on the side of the stage and give him some angry look and like point to the sky, like louder, like that happened because I can't hear well enough. And you know, that's always like, that's a classic one, but it's also kind of confusing, like when you see someone pointing towards the sky because they want to turn themselves up in the monitor, you're not sure if they just want themselves to be louder or if they're saying that this one's for Jesus,
right?
You know,
of course.
And so,
or let's make it louder for Jesus,
yeah.
Or that this clam I dedicate, this mistake I dedicate
to. We've all
sinned. Exactly. We've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God.
Do you guys riff on stage? Are you guys able to improvise on stage?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, that's kind of, you want it to be different, especially if you're playing, you know, we were at the tail end of the touring behind Phosphorescent Blues. Mm-hmm. And when you're specifically touring behind something like that, you know, there's a core group of songs that you're going to do every night. And to make sure that you're not delivering a performance, that you're not mailing it in, because for those people, hopefully there's a large percentage of those people who won't have seen us before.
Right.
If you know, if we step on stage and we feel like, here we go again, then they, you know, that's not fair. That's not fair for anyone there. So I think improvisation is key to making sure that we feel 100% engaged night in and night out. And it's also, I think...
But there's usually a good bit of structure to, like, the improvisation. Like, we don't go on stage and just start, you know, making ocean noises and, and like, look for any kind of cutlery to hit our instruments with. But there's usually, it's always, you know, a juxtaposition of an arrangement with some kind of improvisation. It could be somebody is now improvising a solo with the band playing, you know, the backup parts, or it could be a highly arranged vocal section where somebody is improvising the accompanimental parts. And so it's a kind of multi-layered.
Yeah, but then there's even there is a section of the show that's just completely free. So everything breaks down, and then we just improvise for however long. Yeah,
yeah. There's this instrumental.
Well, why don't you guys tell me when that happens the next time?
Do you ever have?
I thought you'd just been really inspired.
Do you ever have weird? I would be so paranoid if I played an instrument like mandolin or banjo, where so much rides in the articulation of your fingertips that I think I would just I would probably wear those like George Costanza when he was a hand model. Like I'd be so terrified of protecting my hands at all times.
Oh, I get weird about that a little bit, about the condition of the fingertips. I have braces right now.
Yep.
And so for the first time in my life, I am not able to chew my fingernails.
Oh.
This is a big problem.
That's a very important part of puberty.
Big problem for me, because I had no idea, but I've been so used to how my teeth shape my fingertips and fingernails. I know that's so gross.
So it made
right?
a difference for when you went back to playing mandolin?
Yeah, so now that I have to clip my fingernails, it feels really inexact compared to my teeth did.
Oh, because you knew how to get them into the
exact
length.
I didn't know I was doing it, but that's what was happening. And now this stuff, it feels like the difference between like something that's handmade and something that's machine made.
Well, I don't think it's fair that they're making you wear a cone around your head.
Yeah.
It's fair.
I have to say, I think braces on an adult look really cool. I really do, actually.
It's like grills.
I think they look cool. I think it looks cool. Because there's something automatically youthful about it.
That's right.
And it's sort of, I don't know, I actually think it looks pretty cool.
I look energetic.
Because you could have gone for the, like, oh, you put the ones in the back, but then people always talk a little weird when they have, like, the Invisalign back there.
No, they couldn't, my teeth were too fucked up for Invisalign. They said, that's not going to work.
No.
That's not going to
work. Well, we're banking the entire kind of next phase of Punch Brothers on Chris's appearance. And so... I'm a big fan of braces.
Were you ever worried about, like, oh no, if I change where my teeth are, it's going to affect how my voice bounces off my mouth?
Yes. Totally. I was.
We were finishing the record, Phosphorescent Blues, and he
had, from the time we finished tracking to the time we got to around to doing the overdubs and maybe re-singing a couple of things here and there, he had gotten the braces.
And the tone was different.
The tone was different.
It was absolutely different. Yeah.
You can hear it on a record, actually, on Magnet, right? That whole lead vocal was delivered post-braces.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Right. And I think that might be the only lead vocal that was post braces.
Oh no, there's one word in "I Blew It Off."
Yes, and that's actually the most. That's where you can hear the tone difference. There's one word because T-Bone actually had a pretty light touch with our band, and we come in with things, you know, sort of arranged within an inch of their lives, and more or less an idea of what we want to do. So T-Bone was just kind of mostly getting us to back off of that.
Yeah.
Kind of like, hey, you know, guys, 2 hours ago this was pretty cool.
Really good. You should go listen to that.
Yeah, go check that out. But on this one lyric, he really wanted to change one word, and I flew out during the mixing process.
We were mastering, because we flew the word in during mastering.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the very final stage of the record making process. And we had kind of brought up this one word, and we're like, well, we wrote it this way, but we could change it to this other thing, and no one really had an opinion on it yet.
So
and then after
it.
Yeah, and then after a month of living with it, T-Mone was like, we got to change that word.
Yeah. So in I Blew It Off, the song I Blew It Off,
yep.
It was originally, the sun licks the back of my neck through a crack in the window shade. And I was just getting into all the sounds at the ends of those words. And I had other options, including hits. And then T-Bone called me. I was on an airplane. He was like, can you fly tomorrow? I had the day off. I did it. And that word is with braces. Hits. Yeah.
And do you think anyone else notices it, or you guys just notice it?
I notice it every single time.
I notice it.
Does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me, but we definitely had to.
It did bother me. Now I like it.
Now I like it. We actually did have to go in. We had one of the interns at the mastering lab go in with this plugin called Isotope, which like removes clicks and noises mm-hmm. and like random stuff, and just kind of like get rid of like some of the.
He's doing sound. It right now. I sound like Shelley from South Park right now. He's doing it.
These are
live.
The most expensive braces of all time. Yeah. How many flights? How many extra days in the studio?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right.
Every tacked day, on, yeah.
Just to go do one word.
That was per word. That was an expensive word.
But it makes all the difference.
Hits.
Yeah,
the sun hits.
See, hits.
Hits.
Get that word on the record.
You got it.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
It's not bad, right?
Do you guys have weird superstitions? Do musicians have? You must have. Do you have weird superstitions? You always have to do something before a show, or you always have to. Is there anything strange?
Paul is into, well, it's not really superstitious. It's just freaky.
he's giving the explain as much as possible sign where the hand is doing this swiping at the throat.
It's not a superstition, but it's kind of ritualistic.
Keep vocalizing.
Keep vocalizing.
Keep vocalizing about.
Let's stay on topic.
That's the topic.
Just trying to build up some Paul Coart mystique.
So now people are going to want to know what it is.
You have to imagine what weird thing Paul does.
Yeah. Well, Critter pees right before the set every night.
There we go.
That's true.
Let's get back.
But that's just practical. Like, you don't want to get on stage and have to pee.
No, but, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, so. Yeah. No, I drink lots and lots of water until an hour before the show, and then I take a leak about 2 minutes before we walk on stage. Vocal cords are lubricated, and, you know, it helps.
It's just nature.
We toast.
Yeah, we toast every night. We'll raise a glass to each other and say something ridiculous.
Pickle right says something ridiculous, stage. Absolutely ridiculous every night.
Not always.
Sometimes
we pass it around. The toasting abilities.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were going to say it wasn't ridiculous. It is without.
No, I've never said anything in earnest in my entire life.
So that's a tradition. Trust. Is what that's called. Trust. I have an actual superstition, which is if I'm having anything besides water to drink on stage, that I have to have a tiny bit of it before I go on so that I know what it feels like.
Oh.
Before I sing.
I guess that makes sense.
I don't know if that's a superstition or not. I guess that's... No, that's more practical, isn't it?
But if you didn't, would you feel weird?
Yeah, I've
noticed... Then I think it might be a superstition.
Yeah, I feel really very odd. And then I'm liable not to have a sip of the thing on stage if I haven't had it before. Yeah.
Bummer.
That's horrible because that throws the balance off, the caffeine alcohol balance.
So when you're doing stand up, you tour and then you do your album, and then you don't do that material ever again.
Right.
But you guys do your album and then you go out in support of that. So I would imagine the downside of that could be you record it and then you play the song 100 times throughout the year.
Yeah.
And obviously it's going to evolve. Mm-hmm. By the end of your tour, you're like, fuck, this is so much better of a version than we recorded because now we all know it.
Absolutely. Every time. Every time.
But, I mean, don't you think there are some songs that the repetition actually kind of makes it harder and harder?
That's so depressing.
There's some songs that just never got any better.
I think there's a certain magic to still being on the edge of learning something when you record it.
Well, yeah.
And, like, certain things will just kind of flow because you're still exploring what the song needs, and then when you're going to play it live, a lot of times if you really hit it in the studio, you're just trying to recapture how that felt,
the magic of that one take. Yeah,
and that can be tough.
Do you guys all play at the same time when you're recording?
Yeah, we had a couple of things on this last record where we specifically went in and wanted to layer instrument by instrument, like the opening minute of the record. We did it that way.
Familiarity is the track.
Yeah, for the first part. And the second part, we did it in groups of, you know, instruments. So the guitar, bass, and drums did their thing. And then Paul and I went in and layered the strings on top. And then I think the banjo came later or something like that. And then the last section of that song is all live vocal. Lead vocal, we put the harmonies on later.
There's the song that I listen to over and over and over again from Phosphorus of Blues is Familiarity.
Yeah,
that's the one.
I was going to guess because that's 8.5 minutes. Like, it's a really long song in like 3 movements.
Yeah. Basically, that's it.
Yeah, and so that was the one that completely surprised me because I just didn't expect it to have like classical movements, and it really, the song has sections in it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But every part also is really catchy. What was it about that that you said, well, these aren't 3 separate songs, these are all part of the same idea, and we have to do this kind of unconventional thing with these instruments? What was the inspiration behind that song?
So that was definitely a swirling mass of a thing. I remember showing you guys. So one thing that happened is I sat down in my apartment thinking about openings to things, thinking about like the first sound that you hear from some piece of music that you love, so a record or a piece or whatever it is. And I thought about the opening to the Well-Tempered Clavier. So Bach's, you know, dun 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 dun, that thing. And I just started playing the opening to Familiarity and showed you guys at Telluride, and then had this just that it's on again, you hate it but you know it then. So like the end, for instance, is that same melody comes back, mm-hmm. but instead of being in this kind of like weird mechanized sort of concert hall-y thing, it becomes like the reference we kept throwing out there was like Last Waltz,
mm-hmm.
you know, just kind of like this kind of lumbering just but like warm campfire kind of a thing. And the whole lyric is, you know, is about you know, our struggle to kind of connect with each other and what we use, you know, over what do we connect at this point in the world. Like, you know, for ages, people have come together over religion that they didn't necessarily understand,
mm-hmm.
But it made them feel something, or they just wanted to be together with their community, but still with a certain degree of anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that now social media and but then also these clubs, these weird nightclubs that you know, where you go and it's too loud to actually talk to anyone, and no one really actually even likes the music that's there necessarily, but they connect over it, and that's a magical thing that I kind of in my head is somehow tied to to organized religion, to that a lot of times you would go, at least me in my youth, like I would go to church, and I didn't really know what was happening, but I would feel things.
Right.
And I think there's something there, and so that song is this kind of long voyage to just trying to connect. And then the production, you know, mirrors that. So like at the beginning of the song, we're all separate. We were all like in little ISO booths and layering the sound, playing together, but like not at all at the same time, and putting it together later. Towards at the end, you know, at the end of the song, that's like around, you know, all of us in the same room around like a couple microphones to try and kind of drive the point home.
Ah, it's so music nerdy. It's the best. That's so granular. That's fantastic. I love hearing the backstory behind that song because I've listened to that song so many times. It makes it make so much more sense. Because I didn't really know. I mean, I got a sense of what you were saying without being able to articulate it.
Well, I also never want to dictate meaning.
No, of course, because everyone's going to take, you know. And I think sometimes that works for you too. Oh, your song was about. Oh, yes, sure, it was. Exactly. Yes, that's what it meant to you.
After a show, when someone comes up and says, "Hey, what's that song about?" and invariably they also follow that up immediately with what they think it's about.
Yeah.
Which is the best, because then you just go, absolutely,
and it gets you out of the conversation faster too.
Yeah.
Yep, you're right.
Well, thanks for coming to see. What was the? There was a guy who. Or the sister, it was Don't Get Married Without Me, and he thought it was about the Titanic.
Yeah.
He thought it was about the Titanic. There's one lyric, bailing out water while the ship goes down. The song's called Don't Get Married Without Me.
Well, yeah, there's only one boat wreck in the history of boats, so that had to be the one.
And his sister was our runner at a show, and she said, she brought it up instantly saying, "Hey, my brother thinks Don't Get Married Without Me is about the Titanic. It's not, right?"
Yes, no.
Exactly, because then you're screwed. Because your whole I always just say yes. That's what it's about. So then
you said that.
I was I had a
that song is an Aryan anthem. Yes.
Yes. What did you just agree to? Oh, I don't know. I wasn't listening. Oh, no. I honestly wasn't listening. I know this sounds crazy, and I'm sure people pitch you this all the time. There's a song I think you guys would sound amazing covering, and I don't know why I've been stuck on it for the past. Every year I make a playlist on my birthday, and I name it after that year that's coming up. And it's just basically whatever I get stuck on throughout the years on this playlist, so I sort of have this annual diary of whatever I was listening to throughout the year. And for some reason this year I got stuck on Bobby Brown's On Their Own from the Ghostbusters 2 soundtrack.
No way.
Nice.
And I honestly, for some reason, playing it on the way over here when I knew I was going to talk to you guys, when it gets to his rap in the middle where he goes, "Too hot to handle, too cold hold," I sang out loud, "They called the Punch Brothers and they're in control," without really thinking why. But then after I did that, I was entertaining myself in traffic. I was like, "They should totally cover that." I'm sure you get a lot of, "You should totally," but you know, if you're bored and you want to kick a Bobby Brown,
but only if you come in and do the rap.
Rarely defended as ably as that.
Because you even covered,
that's compelling.
Not with the Punch Brothers, but didn't you do Spit on a Stranger?
Yes.
Which is a phenomenal cover of that song.
Oh, thank you. That Pavement record. I know most Pavement fans usually go a little, further back in Pavement's catalog. But that, to me, that Pavement record, Terror Twilight, is so rad. I still think we should cover the song that has the lyric, "Watch out for the gypsy children in electric dresses, they're insane." It's pretty good. I hear they live in crematoriums and smoke your remains.
That's unbelievable.
That's a good lyric, right?
That's a phenomenal lyric.
We could put that in the Bobby Brown rap. We could just sneak it in.
Yeah, because, you know, he just repeats the rap at the end.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing to do.
Why not have new words?
Yeah, why not have pavement? New words? And then I'm telling you, Bobby Brown, weaving Bobby Brown, Pavement, and bluegrass together, no one's ever done that before. You would at least if the audience is like, "What the fuck was," at least they'd go, "Well, I've never seen it." I mean, you know.
Right. At least it's new.
Yeah.
It's not good, but it's new.
I think it would be good, actually. I think it might be good.
Did a nationwide poll just to ask people, to ask Americans what they wanted to hear in their music. and they said they wanted to hear Bluegrass, Bobby Brown, and Pavement.
And Pavement, those three things.
And if you could maybe put a verse about my dead dog in there.
You know, I'm telling you, I think if you wrapped those three things together, I think you could basically hit every major demographic in America, like, all at one time.
Either that or rip a hole in space-time.
You don't know. Yeah, you can be very careful. You guys might all travel back in time. That could be the other thing that happens. You guys are going to play in a second, but I just wanted to give a shout-out to your awesome baby, who I got to high-five me.
He's 5 months old, and Chris, like, goes up for the high-five, and Cal actually did
it. The hand went up, Calvin, and he came fly. I didn't have to go to him.
He did it, some babies. This is not a thing that he does, but he did it for Chris.
Some babies are just like Thanksgiving turkeys. You just got to do it. They're just like floppy. He made the effort to come to my hand, which was an amazing feat for a small baby.
He is the single greatest person who has ever lived.
And your wife and I did a CSI together years ago. Like, which, 9 years ago, I think.
Which is amazing.
Which still airs from time to time.
Is it keeping us in... She's there.
Claire, we're talking about you.
It's keeping you in your house.
Hi, Claire.
What was the location? CSI? Was it a CSI?
It was OG CSI. It was the original CSI.
Oh, well, and Amanda Seyfried was in that episode.
Amanda Seyfried was in that episode, too, yeah.
She's gone on to giant greater things.
Has she done anything else after that? I thought that was it for her. I was going to ask if she's doing okay.
Yeah, but does her boyfriend or husband play the mandolin?
No. I don't think so.
And does her infant child high five awesome people?
No.
Excitedly not.
See? Now I feel like he's got to have some sort of a bluegrass nickname, like, it's old high five, because he's high fived everybody when he was a baby.
I think old high five is pretty good.
Old high five.
Old in front of it makes it.
Yeah. Cal's probably like, yes, anything but crumpet, which is what we currently call him.
Remember, crumpet's for home. When he wants to be fancier at home, and then but out in the streets, he's old high five.
Stage name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't have such luck.
Yeah. Some other baby's going to knife him with crumpet in the streets, you know? He's going to need, like, a badass
baby. Right. You're not going to mess with old high five.
No, you're not going to. You will not mess with old high five. Well, what are you guys going to play? What do you want to play?
Oh, yeah. Let's play Julep.
Julep.
Excellent. Julep.
Yeah.
But first, we'll play Rye Whiskey.
But before you, before we jump into song mode, Phosphorescent Blues is the album, and that's the current album.
Yes.
But how many albums are there total?
There are five, if you count the first thing that we did together, which actually came out as a solo record of mine, which was called How to Grow a Woman from the Ground, and it was under my name, but that should have been a Punch Brothers record.
Gotcha.
I'm just an asshole.
But then you softened up.
I softened up. Well, it was, you know, the braces really take one down a peg. And...
You can't really yell at people.
No.
Come on, guys.
Like this. Exactly.
Say it.
What are you trying to make him say?
Britney Spears. Right? You're dead, Stan. That's what I feel like.
That fucking show's still amazing.
It's still amazing.
Yeah. They just had a brand new episode all about how they were scrambling to get a Whole Foods in town, and they built a hipster district called Soto Sopa, and they built everything around Kenny's shitty shack of a house, and that's what made it like shitty and urban. But then all this fan, and they kept cutting to these live action commercials about the types of dining and like the residences at Soto Sopa. It was fucking amazing. Still like 19 years.
God bless him.
I'm in. I love me some South Park.
All right, it's time for some. Tyrell Miller here.
Music.
Great theater.
That'll be all right. Not gonna make any difference. Okay. Let's do it.
I died happy in my sleep. I died happy in my sleep. Our children
round and you look down from heaven's a julep on the porch. Heaven's a julep on the porch. You and me rocking, grandfather clock is tick tick tock into the time we used to wind in. Sugar and the mint, and he brought the whiskey, asked for my blessing. Yes, sir, I know she's heaven's julep on the porch. Heaven's julep on the porch. You and me rocking, grandfather clock is tick tick talking to the time.
It's just me,
basically.
there's not a ton of people in here.
All right, and now, look at A.
Sure.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.